Hi, I'm Kristen Bell. And if you know my husband, Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.
Your check, your cooperative. As a farmer-owned lender, Farm Credit Mid-America shares the success of the cooperative with our customers, which is why we've returned more than $1.25 billion back to our customer owners over the last 8 years. It's proof being a part of our cooperative pays. Patronage is an annual decision made by the board of directors to return earnings to eligible customers. To learn more about patronage and eligibility, visit fcma.com/patronage.
In May 2018, County Kildare, Ireland, the body of a 14-year-old girl was discovered in an abandoned farmhouse. A lonely teenager. She'd only ever craved friendship, but instead, she'd been mercilessly bullied in school and online before being brutalised and murdered. It was a horrific crime, made even more shocking when the perpetrators were identified. The youngest people ever to be charged with murder in Ireland. This is what happens when children kill children. This is the murder of Anna Creagill. I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen. Hi, and welcome back to my channel. Thank you for joining me. Hope you're all okay. If you are new to this channel, I release my content on a Wednesday and a Sunday, same time, same place, every week. If you like crime and consistency, this is the channel for you. Big shout out as ever to my Patreons and my YouTube membership. Without you guys, can't make these. So you are appreciated, as is every single one of you who comes here regularly, gives me likes, writes a comment, joins me for a live chat. If you haven't joined me for a live chat, join. The community is absolutely brilliant. It's so much fun. And even though it's crime orientated, and of course we're always talking about the cases, it also is a space where we kind of get to know each other. So you feel like there's some interaction with a community of people who have like-minded positions and views, and it's a kind space. So come over, join. Let's talk about today's case. Wow. Like I said at the very beginning, we're going to look at the youngest people ever to be charged with murder in Ireland. And that in itself is a highly disconcerting position. The idea that we're talking about children that kill, it's always the type of crime that sits so incorrectly in the psyche, because it's not expected from what we see usually as innocent, naive individuals growing up, learning who to be and how to be in our society. It's not the malevolence we expect within the spirits of these teenagers. And yet, just as we see with psychopathic serial killers growing up, the latent malevolence exists and is there. But often it seems that the people around those kids didn't even notice the negativity that was brewing. Anastasia Creagill was better known by her family as Anna, and she had had a really tough start in life. She genuinely had. So she was born in February 2004 in a place called Novokuznetsk. That's in Western Siberia. And when she was born, she was placed in an orphanage, and one can immediately make a connection with the reality of how that would be for a baby. Obviously, when a baby is born, there is a desperate requirement for nurture and attention to have those needs met. And even though an orphanage is a place of care and we'll have individuals around to look after the babies, it's not the same. So attentionally, she would be suffering right from the get-go. Now, she was given a new start in life basically in 2006, but bear in mind at that point she was 2 years of age, so that would have been quite an abandoning start to her life. And also, even though the orphanage was probably not the best of places, there would have been a familiarity about that, and suddenly finding yourself adopted and taken to another country, which is exactly what happens to Anna. She's adopted by an Irish woman, Geraldine Creagill. Now, Geraldine has a great job. She's a senior manager in a state public transport company, and her French-born husband, Patrick Creagill, He's somebody who lectured French at the Dublin Institute of Technology. So these are two individuals who are clearly very well equipped to adopt a child. And to all intents and purposes, this is going to be a really great new opportunity for Anna and her childhood, because suddenly she's going to be in a loved position, being given all the opportunities that a child deserves. And even though there's going to be a complete culture shock and without a doubt, some collateral emotional experience and fallout from her 2 years in the orphanage, it's also gonna symbolize and signify a really brilliant new start. So they bring Anna back to Ireland with them. They live in a place called Leixlip, which is just outside Dublin in County Kildare. Now, even though Anna didn't actually have any family ties to Russia, she'd been abandoned essentially, so there were no connections there, her adoptive parents did feel that it was really important for her to have a connection to her birth culture. So they didn't change her birth name, they kept her birth name, Anna. And they felt that that was important to celebrate, essentially, how she came into their lives. Because if she hadn't, of course, been placed up for adoption, they would never have had the opportunity to bring this child into their world and to love this child in the way that she deserved. And also, of course, to be loved by that child. Now, Anna just thrived. She really did. She had a new home, loving parents. She had an opportunity to develop and grow, and she flourished. That's what they said about her when she went to primary school, that she bloomed. She was very lively. She had a really energetic character. She was somebody who was considered by people who knew her to be really full of life, but there were some issues with her health, and we can completely understand why. Just think about her start in life. It certainly wasn't an environment that was going to give the attributes of thriving that she's dealing with now. There's going to be some collateral issues. And she did have some health problems. So first of all, she needed a tumour removing from her right ear, and that actually left her deaf in that ear. So she had some hearing issues, and she also had poor eyesight. So that created some physical vulnerabilities. And there were also issues with her short-term memory. She struggled to retain information. And the thing about going through primary school education per se, even the medical system in the UK, is you're always being compared with others. Whether that's when you first have a baby and they're looking at what quartile your baby measures, whether that's when you're dealing with a health visitor and seeing whether your child can put the blocks on top of one another, as well as what they're expected to do for a certain age. There's a lot of comparisons. And when you go to primary school, there's even more, because people start to measure your academic acumen. And when you've got these issues and you're not quite at the stage of your peers, and it's got nothing to do with you not trying, it just comes down purely to the issues that you have, it's going to make you stand out. It's as simple as that. Your peers are going to notice. We're hardwired as human beings to see differences. And certainly for a child who wants to fit in, that's going to make peer relationships more strained and more problematic. Because like it or otherwise, kids gravitate to kids that they feel familiarity with. And if you don't seem to be familiar, or you don't seem to be an individual that they can connect with because you look different, sound different, act different, it can lead to a level of isolation. And also, aside from the problems that I've just talked about with the vulnerabilities that she struggled with because of her health issues, she also had this exacerbated by the fact that she needed to miss time off school because of those health problems. Now, parents were really worried that these issues were going to lead to her having problems, and meaning that she was behind her peers academically, particularly when she starts secondary school. And even her primary school guidance teacher, they themselves expressed the same concern. One of the things about Anna was she had a very trusting, very naive, very innocent nature, which is a lovely, lovely nature. Qualities like that show a sensitive disposition. They show an empathic personality, but they're also the kind of personalities that can get exploited. They're the kind of personalities that can be harmed by others, so to speak. Also, she did look different to other children. She stood out. I mean, she was tall for her age, and she was striking in her appearance. So she was one of those girls that you would notice because of her height and because of her looks. And she also looked considerably older than her peers. And again, I think if people look back to primary school and secondary school, and you just go through the inventory of all the kids that you went with, you will always remember the ones, particularly the females, who were a foot taller than everybody else, because they just seem and look and appear different, and you notice a disparity between you and them. And often that can lead to that individual feeling that they stand out and that they are not necessarily included in the way that they should be, because people find it strange that they are so distinctively different, like I said, particularly if you're a tall girl. And I can look back at my primary school education and I can literally name two girls, I won't do it on here, but I can name those two girls who absolutely were a foot taller than everybody else. One of the girls just had this popularity about her. She was one of those kind of girls who was going to end up being a supermodel. And the other one, she struggled to have friendships because she didn't have the looks of the other girl, but she had the height that made her feel a little bit distinct from the peers around her. So this is again making her feel potentially less included. And even though primary school had been a relatively good place for her, the teacher did feel that when she transitioned to secondary school, she would be a prime target for bullying, which is awful. But we're not going to pretend that that isn't a reality. We're not going to pretend that young people who don't look exactly like peers or don't fit in the way effortlessly with their peers, that they aren't going to be people who find themselves at points being bullied by others who genuinely use their differences as an opportunity to poke fun at them. And the teacher couldn't have been more right, genuinely. And when I talk about bullying, this is going to be one of those cases where we're talking about it never letting up. We're talking about incessant, consistent, relentless bullying. So Anna starts secondary school. Bearing in mind, she is a very lovely, very sensitive, very sweet girl. She's quite vulnerable because of her health issues, but also because she's very trusting. And we know that she's thrived at primary school, and that essentially should have been something that would have laid the foundations for an excellent secondary education. But it's not going to be the case, because what the peers see is someone that they can essentially use their energies to attack as opposed to include. And the bullying is literally immediate. So she's singled out, and I'm going to express what's in the literature about her and the way that she was referred to by individuals who went to her school. So she was singled out and considered a socially awkward weirdo. So she gets teased for not having a real mum and dad. Essentially, they really poke fun at her because she's adopted. And her father said, people didn't understand her. She was so unique, full of fun. So this exuberant, lovely character of hers, which would have made her the best friend in the world, that wasn't something that peers related to, because she didn't have, I suppose, the depths of cruelty that some kids.
You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to tracemineralz.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. You're doing all the right things, like eating clean and staying active, but nearly all of us are still missing a key piece, minerals. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's not getting, supporting mood, energy, immunity, and nervous system balance. It's made from ionic trace minerals your body actually absorbs and comes in three delicious flavors, blue raspberry, blue Hawaiian, and blue acai. Because your body can't make minerals and modern food and water don't supply enough, start with minerals. Start with Concentrace. Find it now at tracemineralz.com.
Have, because she really was just a sweet girl. That made her even more alien to these kids who essentially had this nastiness within them. Now, the bullying had started prior to secondary school, and partly this was down to social media. So Anna had a lot of accounts on loads of social media platforms, as kids do. Her favourite platform was YouTube. She had very good taste. YouTube is indeed a fabulous platform. She only had about 100 subscribers, but she made loads of videos. And as I've said to you, she wasn't that academically inclined because of all the issues that she'd had to deal with in early childhood. But wow, she was a brilliant dancer. And she had an absolutely beautiful voice. And she was a member of the Leek Slip bass troupe Dance LA. And she also on her channel talked about fashion. And she had a really distinctive alternative style. And you know, she loved colouring her hair. She was somebody who, to all intents and purposes, was finding an outlet to express who she was. In front of that small audience, she was basically building her character and personality. And I think we underestimate just how powerfully important that is for young people these days, being able to connect with others and have reinforcement of your worth and remind yourself that even though you might be a bit unique, there are other people who just love that uniqueness. I genuinely think we should go around telling kids that it's totally okay to be completely weird. It's what's brilliant. We should be embracing that and encouraging that. I think there's an amalgamation approach where young people feel that they've got to be like everyone else and fit in with everything else. And we should really be going around saying, hey, teenagehood is pretty grotesque at times. But you know what? It's a lot easier when you stop trying to act like the person you think you're meant to be and you start being the person you actually are unapologetically and unashamedly. But for whatever reason, we tend not to have those conversations, particularly not at secondary school. And this leads to children and young people feeling that there is a particular way to be and act. And YouTube, particularly for Anna, gives her an opportunity to just be herself. Now, bear in mind, this is her way of innocently connecting with her peers online. It's a way of building relationships, potentially with people that she knows locally, but also with the wider community of the cyber world. But she just ends up getting absolutely incessantly cyberbullied. And this is from older kids at school, and it's from complete strangers, and they literally bombard her accounts with abuse, threats, sexual comments. They even do things like call for her to be executed. They tell her to go die. And those messages are unbelievably challenging psychologically for any person. It really doesn't matter whether you're 6 or 60. That kind of malevolent contact is something that really affects you. And even though you know that when they're sending those horrible messages, it says more about their character than it does about yours, the reality is you're still the one who has to go to school and see those people who are saying horrible things about you, suggesting you should die. Or you're walking down the street and wondering whether the person passing you is one of the people who's anonymously sent you a horrific threat. The fact that Anna is getting this constantly as well, it's reinforcing that feeling of, well, do I have any worth? Maybe these people are right, and so on and so forth. Now, to make matters worse, Anna didn't actually have a really strong peer network. So she'd barely got any friends to turn to for support. In fact, she mostly socialized with her cousins. And when you go to school, particularly secondary school, what you'll often notice is that teenagers in particular tend to walk around in groups. So there might be 3 or 4 people at a time or even more. And that makes you feel really isolated. If you can see groups of kids who all seem to be having fun, all seem to be connected, and you're by yourself, and you're reliant on your family members to have any kind of relational experience, it's really lonely. So Anna always ends up walking by herself. No one wants to associate with her, which is just a travesty because you can absolutely bet your bottom dollar. Anna is a kid who would have been the best friend ever. You would have literally had loyalty, empathy, kindness, compassion, fun. You'd have had all of those things if you just spent some time with her. But because she's alienated, because she's isolated, that means that she's tainted at school. Not because she's done anything wrong, but because that's the role people have given her. Oh, Anna's strange. Anna's weird. Stay away from Anna. And even the kids who may well have wanted to have some kind of connection with her because she's so striking and interesting and lovely, they would be given a warning by the relations that are occurring around them. So no one else is hanging out with Anna. She's getting all the crap towards her. I don't want to join in and be also a recipient of that negativity. So that alienates her even further. But Anna remains upbeat. She's going through all of this, and yet she still tries to have a positive outlook on her life. And this is particularly important to her when she's in her home. She feels very much that her home is a haven and that this is where she can truly thrive and truly be herself. So her parents notice that she comes out of herself when she's actually in the place that's a sanctuary, essentially. And she spent hours on her own just listening to music. She'd sing, she'd practice her dance moves in her room. And her mum said another thing that they loved doing together was just sitting down, watching a film, eating popcorn together. But even though the physical home was a sanctuary, as in no one could cross the threshold, no one could threaten her physically, as in face to face in a home, it wasn't a sanctuary that saved her from the cyberbullying. She couldn't escape that anywhere. Like I said, the word relentless is the only word that we can use when describing the type of aggression and abuse that she faced 24/7 online. It's unbelievable that I'm having to say this. We're talking about this young girl who had a really difficult start in life, who's been taken to Ireland by a mother and father who adore her, and her difference, her small difference to the kids that are around her, i.e. she's been adopted, she's taller, that seems to give them license to just attack her perpetually. What is going on in our society that kids are still made to feel so absolutely alienated just because they're slightly different? And the legitimacy of the pack mentality, that somebody writes something horrible online and then another 100 people think it's okay and legitimate for them to do exactly the same, as if the permission base just infects other psyches and allows them the opportunity to destroy others' characters and personalities in this way. And I use the word destroy specifically because we see time and time again young people having their mental health decimated by this kind of behaviour. And people will often say, well, they can just switch off, they can turn off that information, they can put the phones down. Yes, they can, but it's not going to stop it being out there, and it's not going to stop people doing it, and the kids know that. And that's a really difficult position to be in, because even when you close down your accounts, it doesn't stop the kids saying horrible things in groups about you, and that happens time and time again. And the reason that we talk about this in such a intentionally serious way is because children take their own lives sometimes. I have a friend whose son took his own life because of bullying, and it's devastating to think that a child's life ended throwing himself in front of a train because he genuinely felt worthless because of the incessant attacks created by social media and those getting together to deride his personality and the way that he looked. Now, unsurprisingly, after all the things I've just told you, Anna's mental well-being, it gets hit by all this cruel and completely unwarranted, unprovoked abuse. Bear in mind, Anna isn't engaging in this. She's not responding to this, but it's just being directed at her day in, day out, moment to moment. She actually ends up getting suspended, bizarrely suspended. I genuinely think, what was the school thinking? But you guys know, me and the old general education system, we have a few issues with each other. But Anna gets suspended because she paints a black eye onto her face. Now, anybody with even a little gram of understanding about teenagers, if you see a kid coming to school, they've put a black eye on, what are you going to do? Suspend them, apparently. No, you're going to think, what's the message I'm being given here? What's the message this child is intentionally trying to transmit to me? And as a teacher, that would be, Anna, we need to sit down. Tell me about what you're trying to explain in this particular painting of a black eye. And often it will be an external representation of a very difficult internal feeling. Yes, it's attention seeking. Of course it is. My God, if anybody needs some attention in school, it's Anna. But the reality is that attention seeking requires a response, which is compassion and care. What are you trying to tell me? What is the message within that particular action? Now, her mother said that as far as she was concerned, it was an outward expression of her pain. I would totally agree with that. But you know what? We don't really know, because the school didn't sit down and actually give her an opportunity to express herself. Why do that? Why do that when you can just suspend her? Makes no sense. Things do not make sense. So Anna, again, in this situation where she's struggling, is just rejected and abandoned. And she'd also self-harmed on at least one occasion. For those of you who might struggle with the idea of somebody scratching themselves or cutting themselves to manage pain, what we know psychologically and physiologically is individuals who do it actually feel calm, they get a sense of soothing. So their brain actually releases chemicals that reduce anxiety in that moment. It's a really bad coping strategy, but when you haven't got other strategies or you don't have any better ones, it's a way of managing pain. So she's obviously looking for an opportunity to try to reduce the agony that she's feeling internally. And whether people scratch, because there's often a lot of misguided beliefs around harm. So people will say, well, it's not really bad because they've just scratched themselves. And then they'll look at somebody else who's got a really deep cut and be like, oh, that's really serious. Now, on an injury level, clearly the deep cut's more serious physiologically. But on a pain level, it's about threshold. So somebody can get relief from scratching, which means that they are self-harming seriously. It's just them meeting that need with the scratch versus somebody who cuts deeply, who's got an ability to manage that pain in a different way. So it all needs to be taken seriously, is what I'm saying. I get a bit upset when people talk about kids hurting themselves intentionally for attention. Yes, it's exactly it. If you actually show people your wounds, you want them to notice and offer compassion and help you get support. And also, a lot of self-harmers never show you their cuts. So it's not just about somebody wanting a cry for help. Actually, some people it is just about strategy to cope. So she's doing this herself to manage the pain. And the way that she self-harmed was she cut her arm with her scissors. Another thing that she did that many people will struggle to understand is that they actually looked at her social media, and later it transpired that she was actually setting up multiple fake social media accounts. And on those social media accounts, she was using really abusive language towards herself. She was bullying herself.
Feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to tracemineralz.com and feel the difference minerals make. Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at tracemineralz.com.
She was basically being really negative to herself about herself, but pretending that they were other people doing this to her. Now, people will often think, well, why would anybody want to do that? To actually join in all the negativity and the hostility? Well, there's lots of different reasons for it. First off, she's controlling the level of pain in the way that she attacks herself. That's number one. So she can write horrible things to herself, but she's the person who's done it. So there's some kind of intentional control there. Secondly, one of the things that she's doing is she's essentially owning the actual abuse. So she is using what everybody else is using against her because she has some self-hate. She's got some self-loathing. So essentially, she uses that part of herself, the critical self, the bit that's angry that she doesn't fit in, that she doesn't get on with other peers, that she isn't liked by people. And she's using that as a blameful position. So therefore, she uses that little part of herself who hates the fact that she isn't able to just be like all the other kids. And that part of herself is writing to who she is. So even though it's her doing it, it's the separate selves within the self that are actually utilizing those messages to attack herself. And even though we're talking about her being the same person, understandably that self-loathing, it needs somewhere to go. And for her, it's setting up these accounts and just abusing herself with it. And that is absolutely distressing. This gorgeous young girl, and in the end, she's joining in with the cyberbullying against herself. And she's so alienated, so abandoned by the peers that should ideally have made her feel comfortable and make her feel like she belonged. And instead, she just becomes part of that gang, bullying herself through social media. Now, when a mum discovers this, she's horrified. Of course she is, absolutely. Bear in mind, her mum and dad just adore her. They see this gorgeous girl growing up, so talented in so many ways, and she hates herself. And also, she's wearing some kind of mask because, of course, at home, she's trying to be more carefree, she's trying to be happier, and therefore, it's shocking when they realise just how deeply she's cut by this kind of behaviour and how essentially she's been cut both physically by her own hands and metaphorically through the cyber experience of pretending to be someone else, abusing herself. So a mum really wants to get this behaviour nipped in the bud. So she starts to routinely check her phone, which is absolutely the right thing to do. You want to make sure that you are gauging what's going on in your kids' lives. But understandably, that would also have been a blow for Anna, because having your mum checking your phone means that you don't have the same kind of liberty and freedom to use it in the way that you might have. And bear in mind, she's already a really lonely teenager who's been completely ostracized and made to feel like she didn't fit in. And now again, the limits on her social media experience probably mirrors those feelings of alienation. Now, it's against all this that I've just told you, this backdrop that I've just described, that on the 14th of May 2018, 13-year-old boy knocks on Anna's front door. This 13-year-old boy goes to the same school as Anna, and I can't tell you who he is. There's reporting restrictions, so I can't tell you the name of this lad. So I'm only ever going to refer to him as Boy B, because that's how he's referred to in the press. So Boy B knocks on Anna's door that particular day, out of the blue. This is totally unexpected. Earlier on the same day, Anna had actually had permission to leave school early. She'd been attending her weekly counselling session. Those counselling sessions were really important. She was struggling. They'd been arranged via Kildare Youth Services, because basically, at this point, her parents and her teachers had become really quite concerned about her mental well-being. So she'd been off for this session, which is positive. She'd returned home. She'd basically eaten, then she'd gone up to her room. It's just what she usually did. Normal, typical, habitual behaviour. Now, her mum, Geraldine, she's still at work when Boy B called and basically asks Anna's dad if Anna's in. Patrick calls Anna down. This is an unusual situation. Kids do not call for Anna. So I imagine for Patrick, it was kind of a new thing and kind of a positive moment. There's a young boy, looks about Anna's age. Could this be a positive thing? Could this be a new friend? So Patrick calls Anna down from her room, and then, as any good dad would, he leaves them to talk. Now, as he kind of removes himself to leave them in privacy, so to speak, he actually hears her whispering to Boy B. So she obviously doesn't want her dad to hear the conversation. But again, that isn't unusual. When you're a teenager, you really do not want your mum and dad to be privy to the conversations that you're having. Usually, it's massively embarrassing. You don't want to give them any ammunition for later on when you're sat around the table at dinner and they just bring up some really annoying information that they've overheard. That kind of thing. I'm not saying as a mother I've ever done that. I am saying I've done that a lot of times. Anyway, Boy B basically tells Anna he's got some really exciting news for her. And turns out Anna had this crush on a boy at school. Of course, it's what you do when you're at school. It's the only thing that makes school palatable, unless you are the A-grade student with athleticism that others could only dream of. But if you're just a mere mortal, like I was, if you did have somebody that you had a crush on. It was kind of cool. It made the day pass a little bit more easily. And I went to a girls' school, but the boys' school was across the road. And that meant that on occasion, I would see a glimpse of a boy with a perm that I liked. When I was young, boy perms were in, just throwing it out there. People sitting there going, Emma's never discussed this weird hairstyle taste. They were very cool. Very cool. Late 80s and early 90s. That's all I'm saying. Anyway, she has this crush on this boy. And again, I'm going to refer to this boy as Boy A because the restrictions on reporting mean I have to. So Boy B says, Boy A, who she's got this crush on, wants to meet her. Can you imagine how Anna would feel in that moment? Can you imagine what's going on in the pit of her belly? The butterflies, the excitement coursing through her veins, the sense of instantaneous brilliance that something positive is happening in her world, that she's not invisible, that actually this boy that she likes has noticed her. And even though she was unaware of it, all her dreams are coming true in this moment. So Boy B says that Boy A basically sent him to come and get her because he wants to meet her. But Anna, this ostracized outsider, it must have been amazing. She must have been thrilled. So she grabs her distinctive black and white hoodie and then she follows Boy B out. Before she actually leaves, she turns around and smiles at her dad, tells him that she won't be long. And it's only after she'd actually physically left that Patrick suddenly realized he hasn't asked her where she's going. So he heads towards the door and he sees her going towards St. Catherine's Park. He noticed that the boy was ahead of her. They didn't seem to be talking. And that stuck out because this kid's just called for her. You would imagine that if that were the case, that they were going to go and hang out, they would be having a conversation together. But it seems that she's just following him from behind. That's the last time Patrick would ever see his daughter alive. Just watching her walking off into the distance. So Boy B takes Anna through St. Catherine's Park and onto nearby Glenwood House, which is basically an old abandoned farmhouse on Clonie Road, Lucan, Coldblow. It's a protected structure, and because of that, it had just basically become a ruin. So the roof had collapsed in places, it had partly been gutted by fire, so not exactly a safe environment, and all of the windows had either been bricked or boarded up. But as is, throughout the history of teenagers, the same scenario. Whenever there is an abandoned ruin, teenagers are like, that's where I need to go and hang out. It happens everywhere. Happened in my day, happened in my own kids' day. We had an abandoned house nearby, literally. If you needed to know where they were going to be there. Probably sat on some old grotesque mattress. Probably, if you took a deeper look, there'd also be things like needles and used condoms around. You know, the kind of perfect place you want your kids to hang out when they're 11 to 14. But this is just the same. It's been there since the beginning of time with teens, hasn't it? You go and find somewhere quiet where adults aren't stupid enough to go because of the things I've just mentioned, and that gives them a sense of privacy. So kids would go there to drink and have romantic liaisons, make of that what you will. And in one of the smaller back rooms of that particular property, we have 13-year-old Boy A. And he is indeed waiting for her, just as Boy B had suggested he would be. But the only thing that Anna isn't aware of is that as opposed to Boy A being in that place, waiting for Anna, because he wanted to connect with her, because he'd found out that she had a crush on him and he indeed had a crush on her. That's what Anna believes, right? But Anna had no idea that actually this is all lies. This isn't about a romantic connection. This is about a trap. This is about a planned trap. And Boy A, he has absolutely no intention of letting Anna walk away. Now, Boy B, he says that what had actually transpired was that a few weeks earlier, he'd been approached by Boy A. These two were incredibly close friends, by the way. So they're good mates. And Boy A, a few weeks earlier, goes up to Boy B and says, have you ever wanted to kill someone? Boy B says, no, I mean, it's not one of those normal questions, is it? Have you ever wanted to kill somebody? I'm literally 13. I want to read comics and watch films about superheroes. No. You know, it's not what you expect. Equally, kids say really stupid things. It's part of being a kid. We can give them some license to have those conversations. But this is how it begins. So when he says no, he's actually asked by boy A to describe why he didn't want to kill somebody. And boy B said, quote, it was retarded. So clearly very differing opinions on what is appropriate behaviour. Boy B being very clear that it would make no sense to kill somebody. Boy A being confused as to why boy B wouldn't think it was a cool thing to do. But this is enough to provoke boy B to ask a question. So who is it that you want to kill? And without hesitation, boy A had said, Anna Kriegel. Literally, without any hesitation. So this kid isn't just thinking about killing somebody, not toying with the idea, not just fantasizing. He's now actually fixated on a potential victim, which is very unusual for the age frame that we're talking about. Now, when boy B brings Anna to that abandoned house, boy A was literally waiting with a kill kit he brought. It contained black gloves, shin guards, knee pads. He had thick builder's insulation tape. Actually, that tape had recently been given to him by boy B. He had this zombie mask that had this skull design and it actually only covered the top half of his face. And he had sharp teeth that had been cut into the upper jaw and they'd been painted red. He had a black snood type scarf, which was to cover the lower half of his face, which is just like something out of a horror movie immediately. I'm describing this and it feels like I'm describing a scene from The Purge. Boy A hadn't actually brought any weapons, even though he got this kill kit essentially. He hadn't brought any specific weapons. And the reason for that is there was enough around in that abandoned house to use. So at the scene itself, there were lots of things that could be very, very dangerously utilized. And bear in mind, he's waiting in this really dark room. It's just like the rest of the house. It's got littered with rubbish, with debris, including cans, bottles, there's cigarette butts, there's condom wrappers. So it's a grotesque, dirty place that he's waiting for in the dark, armed with this kill kit, ready to strike. Now, the exact sequence of what played out, the events that actually transpired, it's never fully likely to be known. But what we do know is that boy A is dressed in his terrifying kill kit. And at this point, he launches the most unbelievably brutal attack on Anna. Now, boy B, he flees the scene. And as he ran away from that scene, apparently he heard Anna's screams coming from the house. Geraldine, Anna's mum, she returns home from work shortly before 5:30 p.m. And at this point, she actually asks her husband, where's Anna? So Patrick says, well, she left with this particular boy. He knows the first name of the boy that goes to school with her and that she'd left with him. Now, Geraldine at this moment in time is immediately concerned because she says to Patrick, well, she doesn't have anything to do with this boy. Why would he call round for her? No one ever called round for Anna. So she immediately at that point is suspicious and she texts her daughter straight away, just two words, home now. And then shortly after that, she sends another message around 5:25 p.m. and says, answer me now or I'm calling the police. Totally concur with that reality. I know that a lot of us have got young children and I know that we have to allow them some independence, but it's all about habit, isn't it? If you're used to a particular type of behaviour, it doesn't provoke anxiety. But if you've got a child who literally never goes out, never gets called for, no one ever comes round for her, and then suddenly some guy has come round from school who she really doesn't have any relationship with and she's gone off with him, that's going to send you into a panic because she knows the trouble that Anna has had at school. Why now is somebody going to be calling around for her and taking her out? Now, Geraldine said, when she did that, she did have a feeling that she could be overreacting, but her gut just said, no, something isn't right. And when she doesn't get a reply from Anna, and when she couldn't get hold of her, She then physically goes out to look in St. Catherine's Park. This is at 5:40 p.m. So this is a very short time period from her finding out that Anna isn't in the home to actually physically going and searching. There is something within her intuition and instinct that is saying there is something wrong. This doesn't add up. This doesn't make sense. I think that my daughter could be in danger. Now, she doesn't find her daughter there. So then she starts driving around the estate. She's looking for her because she thinks to herself, well, maybe she's just walking. Maybe she's just listening to her music because she loves walking and listening to her music. But to no avail. She can't find Anna. So eventually at 9 p.m. she reports her missing. Now by this time, Geraldine and Patrick have actually managed to do some detective work. They've established Boy B's second name and they've found him on Facebook and they give this information to the Garda, which is so important, of course, because this child is potentially the last person who has seen Anna. So that same night, officers go around to speak to the boy at his home in the presence of his parents. So they quiz him about Anna's disappearance. Now, he does confirm, yeah, I called at her house earlier that evening and she came with me to St. Catherine's Park. But he says that's the last time he'd seen her. He doesn't mention at this point anything of Boy A to the officers. Now, Boy A, on the other hand, he's returned back to his parents' house. Straight away, his parents know something is off. So first of all, he's really pale. He looks really shaken up. Clothes are all covered in dirt. He's got debris over his trousers and clothes. Also, they notice there's blood on them. So, of course, they're immediately worried for their son and they say, what on earth has happened to you? And he says, well, I got beaten up by two boys on my way home. So his parents are absolutely angry as you would be. How dare somebody beat up their child. So they report the matter to the Garda, to the police. Now his mother then goes about sorting things out, as we do, as mums do. If your kid comes in and they've been bullied or attacked and they're covered in rubbish, you're going to run them a bath and you're going to wash their clothes and you're going to give them comfort. So she washes all of his soiled clothes and makes sure that he's okay. And you can tell that they're responsible parents because their first instinct was to speak to the police. They took it very seriously that the son had suggested he'd been beaten up by these two boys. Officers, in the meanwhile, they're speaking again to Boy B. This is the following day because Anna hasn't gone home. And they've put out this missing person alert to the public. You can imagine how Anna's parents are going to be feeling at this moment in time, can't you? The fact that their daughter has not come home, the fact that she's quite a vulnerable kid, the fact that she's got health issues and she's not returned, they are going to be absolutely desperate. I cannot comprehend or pretend to understand the way you would feel in a moment where you are having a child missing and they haven't returned and there has been a whole night that's passed. Because all you're going to think about are the dangers that could have befallen them. And with every passing minute, the reality that you may not have your child ever return home must press on your conscience so heavily. Now, when the police go back the following morning to speak to Boy B, he starts to change his story. So now we have a different version of events that basically unfolded the previous evening. So at this point, he starts to say, well, Boy A basically asked me to bring Anna to him because Boy A knew that Anna liked him. But basically he wasn't interested. So he asked me to go and get her so that he could then meet with her and tell Anna that he wasn't interested in a relationship with her. So Boy B said that's what he'd done. He collected Anna from her home as instructed, taken her to St. Catherine's Park where Boy A was waiting. And then he said that they had a short conversation after which he and Boy A had left and Anna, as far as they were concerned, returned home. Now, the officers think this is a bit weird. First of all, why is the story changed? I mean, if there's nothing suspicious or problematic occurred in the interaction between Anna and Boy A, Why?
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use, and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's R-A-K-U-T-E-N, Rakuten.com.
Would he have withheld that information the day before? Particularly when we're talking about a missing child. And this really concerns the officers. He's changing his events. He's involving somebody else now. And they also are very aware, from talking to him, that he's a very bright lad. He's a very intelligent individual, remains really calm throughout the questioning and tries to piece things together in a way that makes sense. But the officers genuinely feel, in spite of all this, the calmness, the intelligence, the story that he's now suggesting occurred and played out, it doesn't add up. It really doesn't add up. But now we have Boye introduced into the situation. So now the officers need to speak to Boy A, because obviously Boy B has now introduced him into this situation. And of course, both of those boys have basically been the last people potentially to have seen Anna. And at this point, bear in mind, the police are considering Boy A and B to just help with their inquiries. They're not seeing them as suspects. They're just feeling that maybe they've got information that's important that can help them bring Anna home. Boy A straight away denies any knowledge at all of Anna's whereabouts. Basically said they'd met in the park. She'd asked him if he wanted to go out with her, and he had gently turned her down and she'd left. He then said that he'd made his way home, and it's at this point he gets attacked by two older teenagers en route. He said that they'd got him, pushed him to the ground, kicked him, but he'd fought back, and at that point they'd run away. Now, the officers obviously did a quick examination to look at his injuries, and they saw that his arm and his leg were injured. They also saw that his face was cut. But again, there's just something about the way he tells the story that just doesn't sound right. So Boye goes into detail, giving a description of these attackers who've basically assaulted him on the way home. But they look at the CCTV, and there were literally no suspects that can be identified. So these individuals seem to have just vanished into thin air, or they never existed in the first place. Now, the police are obviously desperately looking for Anna at this moment in time. They're scouring the area. And earlier on in that day, one of the officers had actually spoken to a man who said, listen, you need to check behind the sewage works because teenagers genuinely hang out there a lot. And at that time, the man was with his teenage son. It transpires that it's Boy A and his father. So it's Boy A's father who's actually suggesting where they should go and look potentially for Anna, because this is apparently a normal place that these kids are going. Still, they turn up nothing. And days pass. Now authorities are really concerned for Anna's well-being. it becomes less likely after 24 hours that somebody will be returned home alive. And we're talking days now. And this is a girl who's never gone away from home. She's never run away. She has no reason to leave. In fact, the safest place in her world is her home. That's where she's least likely to be attacked. It's where she's least likely to feel vulnerable. And yet she's taken nothing and just disappeared. But then we get to the 17th of May, 2018. This is 3 days after she disappeared. And they make what can only be described as a grisly discovery. It's made by the Garda team. They were searching Glenwood House at the time. And as I told you earlier on, it's very dark, it's very dirty, and it's difficult to see things. And in one of the rooms, an officer enters, and it's not what he sees, it's what he smells. He can smell the metallic of dried blood. I think that for those of you with a good sense of smell, you'll know that smell. It's like a particular type of scent, and that's what he actually inhales. It's a recognition. He's smelt this before, and he knows that there is a likelihood that somebody has bled in this room enough to cause that scent. But it's really dark inside. All the windows are boarded up, and he's kind of letting his eyes adjust. And as he does so, he makes out what he believes is a mannequin on the floor. And as he gets closer and closer, he realises to his horror it isn't a mannequin. It's Anna's battered body. She's naked, except for her socks, and her hair is just covering her face. Even in the dark, whilst looking at her corpse, the officer knows that she's been somebody subjected to a violent and brutal assault. She's got bruises and lacerations all over her body. He also notices there's a very long, heavy stick and a cement block lying nearby, and both of them are just covered in blood. Also, there's blue insulation tape, and it's been wrapped around Anna's neck. She literally died with three of her fingers still inside the tape, trying to remove it, no doubt. Also, as they start to examine the scene and, of course, to examine Anna, they realise that she's been sexually assaulted also. To find a child and to witness the brutality of how she's been murdered, and then to also note that she's actually suffered a sexual assault. This is a young girl. She was at primary school a few years earlier. And the way that she's been murdered is just absolutely harrowing. When they do the autopsy, it gets worse with respect. I mean, she suffered shocking injuries. She'd suffered multiple fractures. She had bruising, she had lacerations to her body, and there were actually over 55 separate injury sites. Many of those injuries were to her head alone. So she had extensive bruising on her face, she had fractures to her eye socket, upper jaw, cheekbone, and even to cartilage in her neck. The two main areas of impact that were to her face, they themselves could have rendered her unconscious. They were so serious, so severe. She had four lacerations to the back of her head. And again, they were caused by some really severe impacts, separate severe impacts. She'd been struck by some fairly heavy object that also had small striking surfaces. So what they drew from the scene and from what they could piece together, they suspected that initially she'd been beaten to the floor with the stick, and then she'd actually been hit around the head repeatedly with the cement block. They also found in the autopsy that she had hemorrhaging to the lining of her eyelids. That's typically caused by a lack of oxygen, and that typically comes from strangulation. She also had these multiple lacerations to her face and her neck. That included an 11.5 centimetre laceration down the left side of her face. And areas of her body had been covered in layers of dust and debris. And the investigators put together what they suspected happened. They believed that she was basically attacked as she entered the room, which was near the doorway. Then she'd been dragged further into the room, and that's where the assault had continued. And then her body had become covered in dust and debris while she was being dragged around, which is just a harrowing idea, isn't it? This poor kid. Also, Anna had lost a huge amount of blood in the attack, which is why the aroma had been there. And the ferocity of the attack was so grotesque and so grave and so sustained that there was literally blood all over the walls. So you can see the amount of aggression just in that description. They were able to establish that Anna had basically died from blunt force trauma to her head and neck, and also compression of the neck, which they found in the autopsy to be very severely bruised. But they don't think that that had been caused by the insulation tape that was around her neck. They believe that it came from manual asphyxiation. It's also testament to Anna, because she must have been absolutely petrified. But in spite of that fear, in spite of the shock, in spite of the absolute profound distortion to what she thought she was walking into, you know, she thought she was walking into a meeting with a potential love interest. She was excited, she was hopeful, and then all of a sudden, she's being beaten to death. You can't even comprehend how you shift psychologically from one extreme to the other, from joy and elation to devastation and terror. But in spite of this, she fought fiercely for her life. They found lots of defensive bruising to her hands, to her limbs. Her false nails had been torn off in the struggle. So she was really fighting. And it's testament to that girl that she was a warrior, even though she couldn't, in the end, be victorious. At least she died fighting. She really did. She was a brave, brave girl. Sadly, they also confirm their fears about the sexual assault. They find evidence of attempted penetration, and they find bruising of fat around the pubic bone and also fresh bleeding to areas around her vagina. So there'd definitely been an attempt to penetrate Anna's vagina. They didn't find any semen in her body, but they did find some on her torn shirt. So the medical examiner concluded that Anna was either unconscious or she was at least restrained in some way when the attempted rape occurred. And the evidence also indicated that she'd not been sexually active at the time of her death. They also concluded that there were no drink or drugs detected in her system. In fact, she'd been in excellent health when she suffered the most horrific death. Now, Anna's funeral took place on the 31st of May, 2018 in Dublin. Her family actually asked mourners to wear sparkle and colour. They had a Russian flag and a matryoshka, which is a doll, and they were placed on her coffin along with a miniature Eiffel Tower. She'd apparently loved her holidays to France. During the service, the priest said this: "We are all numbed, confused, very angry and bewildered that such a thing has happened to the most beautiful, caring, kind, strong-willed, crazy, sometimes cheeky, but always a loving princess. That was Anastasia Krejcil." I understand that shock. In a community like that, the loss of a child in such a diabolical way, it stains the conscience of every adult, because it feels so wrong that this kind of murder could possibly play out in their locality. Also, we've got to remember that Anna was not an individual who was living some kind of wild life. She wasn't involved in dangerous activities. She was an innocent, naive girl. She spent most of her time at home with her parents, listening to music, dancing, dreaming, no doubt, of a happier time that would come in the future. And suddenly, she's found brutalised in this way. It makes no sense. Following the discovery of Anna's body, police then have to go about thinking about who could possibly be responsible for this murder. So they start looking, of course, on the CCTV footage, because hopefully they're going to be able to see the coming and going of certain individuals, and hopefully that will lead them to the perpetrator. Bear in mind, at this moment in time, the police are going to be thinking that they're looking for a sex offender, for somebody with a violent history, individuals who have form, because this kind of murder is rare. And ultimately, They're thinking there's a potential for this person to strike again. So they're analysing lots and lots of hours of CCTV footage. So at this point, they identify a teenager who they believe, from looking, is Boy A. Now he's near St. Catherine's Park, heading towards Glenwood House. But also, he's carrying a backpack. Now a witness later also says that they saw a teenager shortly after climbing into a field and heading towards an abandoned farmhouse. And around the same time, we've got Boy B and Anna. Now they're caught on CCTV walking towards St. Catherine's Park. And again, another witness also saw them in the park shortly after. Now around an hour later, both Boy A and Boy B were separately caught on CCTV heading away from the park. So this is starting to cause real concern. First of all, yes, they'd admitted that they were in the park, but they didn't say anything about going to the abandoned farmhouse. Secondly, it feels like they did get together. And we have Anna, who doesn't seem to leave the situation, but both these boys separately do. So the police bring in Boy B again, because we're now dealing with a murder inquiry. And what I would say is that calm demeanour that he definitely had when he was speaking to the police prior, it alters. When he sees the crime scene photographs with Anna's body pixelated out, but nonetheless there, he stated in reference to Boy A, "Jesus, one of my closest friends." So he's shocked, ultimately, by what he's seen. Even though he took Anna there in witnessing what has happened in the demise of this poor girl, it's triggered something. Conscience, morality, shock. And suddenly he's acknowledging that he's not okay with whatever has transpired. So finally, he admits taking Anna to the abandoned house and leaving her with Boy A. Boy A had then told him to leave, but Boy B had said for whatever reason, he decided to look back through the abandoned house because he heard this shuffling from the other room. So he goes back, goes to have a look, and apparently saw Boy A judo flip Anna to the floor. Apparently Boy A did martial arts. Then he saw him choking Anna and tearing off her clothes. Boy B actually heard her begging for him to stop. And at one point, both Boy A and Anna had turned and looked at him. And at this point, Boy B had fled. He said that as he ran, as he left, he heard a really strong scream from Anna. Now, I would imagine that you'll all feel exactly the same in this moment, which is why didn't he intervene? Why didn't he go and get help? Why did he look at that scene? Look at Anna's desperate eyes, look into those eyes, and then leave. But he hears that scream, and then he said, then he heard noises where it sounded like she was being muffled at the end, as if her mouth was being covered. Now, even though Boy B is now being forthcoming with this information, investigators still don't believe he's telling the complete truth. And they were right. Because in the end, he provides further details to a doctor. And he actually told that doctor that he saw Boy A standing over Anna with his trousers open during the attack. And then he saw Anna gasping before going silent. Now, both Boy A and Boy B are arrested at this point and they're charged with Anna's murder. Boy A is understandably and rightly also charged with aggravated sexual assault. They plead not guilty to all counts. Now, I cannot comprehend for one minute why Boy A would plead not guilty. Boy B, I would imagine family and lawyers would all feel that there was a potential to have him separated from murder. But we have to all be aware that he's led her to her murder. He was complicit in leaving her and he didn't intervene when he could have actually made a difference. So it's perfectly right that he's charged with murder. But obviously he's not been involved in the sexual assault at all. But pleading not guilty means that the family have to go through the ordeal of a trial. Now, prior to the trial, Judge Justice Paul McDermott, he banned the defendant's identification. The reason for that is because you're innocent until proven guilty, but if your names get put out there, you're obviously going to be in a very vulnerable situation, particularly when a young person has been murdered like this in such a brutal way by young people. There can be a real vigilante feeling in the local community that justice needs to be served. So by not putting their names out there, essentially you're protecting the defendants and also their families. But the order actually gets ignored by cyber vigilantes. So what actually happens is the names, the images, they end up appearing all over Facebook, all over Twitter. So then there's a subsequent injunction ordered, and they order the platforms to remove all of the posts. And representatives, in fact, of the companies have to attend a hearing, and they face essentially potential contempt of court charges because they allowed confidential details to be published. However, what the companies argued was that they couldn't prevent the information being posted, as due to reporting restrictions, they hadn't actually known the names of the defendants, so they didn't know who to block or what to block. And that makes perfect sense. Essentially, they aren't aware that these names are actually protected, and because of that, they can't protect them. Now, the police continue questioning boy A about Anna's death, and he just continues to absolutely deny any knowledge or responsibility. This is despite the fact that they've already found the backpack in his room containing the kill kit. They've also got him on CCTV wearing the backpack. Also, doesn't help that they apparently find a book containing a satanic pledge in his house. What is it about satanic pledges and satanic information that so many of these killers seem to connect with? It's unreal. Police then take his clothing away. Of course they do. They take the footwear that he'd worn on the night. Bear in mind, this is the night that he claimed he'd been beaten up. So when the boots come back with a positive for traces of Anna's blood, he actually states, "Are you joking me? Are you actually being serious?" "Yeah, yeah, kid. We're being serious. Being serious because you're on CCTV wearing the backpack that's in your room with the kill kit, the trainers that were downstairs that your mum had sorted out with traces of blood from the person that you murdered. Those are kind of pretty, pretty implicating things. Do you not think?" "No, totally innocent. Genuinely. We're seeing the childishness and emotional immaturity in this moment."
Feel off? Tired? Moody? You might be missing minerals, because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to tracemineralsmg.com and feel the difference minerals make. Missing minerals? 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps restore what your body's missing, naturally supporting mood, energy, and immunity. Get yours now at TraceMinerals.com.
Aren't we? There is no way he isn't banged to rights, but he just believes that if he keeps denying it, then hopefully in the end that will stick. When he's interviewed, aside from those minor statements, which is all about denying any culpability and responsibility, he basically answers no comment to the questions, or he claims he doesn't know. Also, they're able to trace Anna's blood again on his backpack and on the contents of his murder kit, including that horrible mask. And also, if that isn't absolutely incriminating enough, they find the semen on Anna's torn top and can match it with him. Now, Boye, this hideous human child, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a kid. And he is far from your typical murder suspect. So he's from a stable, middle-class home. Teachers, how did they describe him as? Courteous and intelligent. However, in spite of this mask of morality, this stability in his nature, according to those who taught him, we see a completely different side to his nature when the police search his phone and his hard drive. Wow. A real dark side. So they look at the contents, and those contents included more than 12,000 pornographic images, and many of those images depicted sexual violence. Also, he'd done searches for child pornography and bestiality. He'd even researched methods of torture. And even more alarmingly, he'd researched abandoned places in Lucan. So this is a child with two sides. The mask that he wears to present to those people who know him, and the true nature that resides within him, the side that he keeps secret. And I think we also have to note at this point how damaging access to pornography for children of this age is, because it escalates. You're titillated initially by sexual shots that aren't aggressive and abusive, but as you get used to them, you search for darker and more degrading images. And like it or otherwise, there is a desensitization that occurs in many cases. And the younger that these children have access to this kind of material, the more potential damage that can do. I'm not blaming pornography for this child's actions. I'm saying it certainly will have exacerbated the malevolence within him. So the trial commenced on the 29th of April 2019. Now, in Ireland, the age of criminal responsibility is 12, but this does actually drop to 10 where rape or murder is alleged. Now, both the defendants in this case had been 13 at the time of the killing, so therefore they are criminally responsible and can be tried as such. Now, the prosecution, they alleged that boy A and boy B had basically devised a plan to murder Anna together. So boy B had lured her into the trap, and then boy A had sexually assaulted and killed her. They said that boy A had carried out the attack. He had carried out the murder and the act of sexual assault, but boy B had been an accomplice, so a co-conspirator, and had assisted the murder. He knew it was going to happen. He didn't stop it. He actually encouraged the situation, and therefore he is equally responsible. Boy A just maintains his innocence. Yeah, just thinks, I've chosen this position. I'm just going to stay in this position. Do you really want to stay in this position though? Because this position is not a very tenable position. I just want to stay in this position. I'm innocent. The thing is, when we look at a spectrum of potential innocence, and then we look at every factor that could ever intrude on that spectrum, and actually mean that the spectrum dissolves and just becomes guilty as hell, you're on that particular end of that particular spectrum. The one where it's just everyone's going to know you're guilty as hell and you saying you're not is a bad idea. Are you going to rethink this? No, I'm innocent. Genuinely, makes no sense. I will bring it psychologically to this position. He loves his parents. In spite of his, shall we say, fractured self and darkness within, because there are certainly incredibly callous antisocial traits within him, but that doesn't mean that he doesn't care for his family, and he may wish to convince them that he's innocent above anybody else. He may not care at all about whether anybody else believes him. If his parents have a bias, and an understandable bias, by the way, I'm gonna be honest, if you have a child who's never put a foot wrong, who's considered courteous and lovely by everyone, and essentially this is a bolt out of the blue, it's so blindsiding, you don't recognize this possibility could have ever occurred in your world. And this child is saying, no, I didn't do it. As a loving parent, even with all the evidence being put in front of you perfectly, it's going to be hard to not believe your child. And I know that some of you might struggle with my beliefs regarding this, but I'm saying, if you've never seen your child in any way, shape or form act in this malevolent or aggressive way, and they're saying, no, mum, it wasn't me. No, dad, it wasn't me. Part of you is going to desperately want to believe that. And if he can even sense there is a possibility, a potential that they may believe him a little bit, it's worth him going for that. Because if he's going down, he's going to want to make damn sure he's got somebody to come home to in the end and somebody to support him whilst he's in prison, etc. So he maintains this innocence, refuses to admit any responsibility, and also because of that, he expresses absolutely no remorse, absolutely unable to acknowledge the impact that his actions had. And bear in mind, this is in spite of the overwhelming forensic evidence. You know, He can't deny he was at the scene. But what he explains is it had just been a fight with Anna. He didn't intend to hurt her. He didn't intend to kill her. He didn't intend to cause a serious injury. You know, as far as he's concerned, this is just all a mistake, and he certainly isn't a murderer. And then his defense team, they actually suggested that there'd been sexual activity between him and Anna, and that that had potentially been consensual. So we're now in a scenario where he's not denied the reality that he's there, but he's denied the reality as to what happened and also to the relational experience between he and Anna. So the defense are going for, let's confuse the jury and put in just that tiny little bit of doubt. Because remember, you have to prove beyond reasonable doubt that they intentionally murdered Anna. If they can levy a little bit of foundational fracture and say, this kid is denying that he murdered Anna because he didn't murder her. It had just been an unfortunate fight and there had been sexual connection because it had been wanted, then that could potentially mean one of the jury or two of the jury or even three of the jury start to question the legitimacy of the murder charge. Now, Boy B's defense, they actually claim that he'd suffered PTSD after witnessing the attack on Anna. So their argument is he basically was so stunned, so shocked by what he'd seen play out that it had caused him to lie. Basically, he couldn't imagine in his mind the possibility that he actually felt Boy A was going to kill Anna. So he hadn't ever intentionally taken her there for her to be murdered. He'd taken her to the abandoned house for his friend, who he thought was joking when he'd expressed the earlier desire to kill her. And that when he'd actually started to see this play out in front of him, he was so traumatized that it basically meant he couldn't think straight. And so he lied to the authorities. Just gonna throw it out there, defense team. That's not how PTSD works at all. Seriously. Don't make you lie to the authorities. It does sometimes have an issue and an impact on memory and the way that you recall things, but usually we also diagnose PTSD at least 6 to 12 months after the event. That's why it's called post-traumatic stress disorder. So arguably, this is what they're saying and doing. Their argument is he didn't know this was actually going to occur. He couldn't have conceived that Boy A genuinely had this level of malice within him. Again, we can break it down in different ways. It can be that he's fully complicit and that he absolutely wanted Anna dead, just as Boy A did. Or we could argue that Boy B genuinely didn't think, because he, in his mind, couldn't imagine murdering somebody, that Boy A was ever really going to go through it. He was doing what his friend had asked him to do to bring Anna there, but he hadn't really thought through the potential of it ending in the way that it ended. It could well be the case. We could well give license to Boy B in that way, but it's kind of irrelevant when you're looking at a murder charge, because it's the chain of causation. You can say, I didn't believe he was going to kill her. And you can indeed in your head be thinking that when you're taking somebody to the murder scene, but you still carried out the action after being informed by the person who did carry out the murder that they had fully intended to do that. Your not knowing whether it was real or otherwise does not discount the action of you leading her to her death. And that's essentially what the jury have to figure out. Is that the case? That in spite of him maybe not believing this was going to end the way it did, is he still culpable? So we get to the 18th of June 2019. It's been a 7-week trial and it's a 14 hours deliberation. So there is a lot to talk about. They're taking this very seriously. These are two young boys. The jury come back. They find Boy A guilty of Anna's murder and sexual assault. So we get to November 2019. He's sentenced to life with a review period after 12 years. He also received a concurrent 12-year sentence for aggravated sexual assault. He's also placed on the sex offenders register, and rightly so. And he apparently cried and held his father's hand when the sentence was passed. And I think that in that moment, any of us can still feel a level of empathy for that second. It's not that we can in any way accept the actions of this child. What he did was grotesque, disgusting, and has changed the course of Anna's family's life forever. But when you're thinking about what separates this child from an adult offender, the reaction of crying and holding his dad's hand when the sentence is passed just brings it back into that sharp focus that we're dealing with a 13-year-old. And even though he's got this horrendous malevolence and destructive nature within, he's also a child, and there are these childlike reactions in that moment. And for his family, one can only imagine what they're trying to compute in that moment, because their world has shifted and changed beyond reason and beyond recognition. Then they talk about boy B. He's also found guilty of Anna's murder. Now, he gets sentenced to 15 years, but he gets a review after 8 years. Because they're young, these reviews are important. There is a belief that if you can create intervention and appropriate strategies early on and monitor them effectively, there is a chance that change can occur. Now, the earliest that that means boy B can be released is June 2027. Now, he, when the sentence was passed, hugged his mum and just kept his head down as they read it out. His father, however, well, he just stormed out of court. But then he re-entered and he was just doing a slow hand clap. And then he congratulated the court for sending an innocent boy to prison. Now, as a mother, there is a part of me that can kind of comprehend and understand the reaction of the father. As far as he is concerned, he does not believe that they are equally culpable and responsible for the murder of Anna. But I think it's a real misstep by the father. Number one, your child got involved in the orchestration and the carrying out to some degree, because he didn't intervene and stop the murder of Anna. Therefore, he is complicit. It may be horrible to be able to hold that and to know that your child is responsible for ending the life of another child. And it must be very difficult when you love your child to fundamentally accept that they were capable of involving themselves in such a horrendous master plan of murder. But it happened. Equally, I can also empathize with that sense of, but he didn't physically abuse her, he didn't sexually assault her, he didn't land any fatal blows, he walked away. And therefore, how can that, as far as his father be concerned, be murder? But it is murder. And the law is the law. And it doesn't have to be simply A, B, C. I got a victim, I killed a victim, I've been sent to prison for killing that victim. It can be a chain of causation of complicity. So essentially, boy B had different points where he could have had a different outcome occur for Anna, such as telling a teacher when boy A started to create this master plan, or refusing to go and get Anna on the day that she was murdered, and certainly doing something when he realised that boy A was actually going through with the murder. These points of possibility are sliding doors moments and could have changed the outcome for Anna. But he didn't. He ran away, hearing her screaming as she was murdered. As I said, that doesn't mean that we can't have empathy and sympathy for both boy A and boy B's parents. Now, those two boys, they became the youngest people in Irish legal history to be convicted of murder. When they're released, just like the Bulger killers, they'll be offered new identities. So essentially, yes, their lives have been put on hold, and yes, they will serve a period of time in prison, but one day they'll be free, and no one will know the horrors that they inflicted on Anna. No one will know that they're murderers. Also, it's worth noting that the jury, who had to listen to the details of this particular case, they've been excused from any further jury service for the rest of their lives. It's very rare that they do that, and they do that because of the level of trauma that's inflicted on the jury. Now, another thing that this tragic case highlights, in my opinion, is the multitude of serious issues caused by a largely unrestricted and unregulated internet. Just the insidious nature of certain social media platforms, it allows for this anonymous trolling, this anonymous cyberbullying of individuals who genuinely get their lives ruined by these horrendous individuals attacking them, and no consequence for them. Anna was a young teenager. She was bombarded with threats of violence, sexually explicit messages, aggressive bullying, and the only crime that she was ever guilty of was being slightly different in the tormentor's eyes. They saw her as unique and they didn't like that. The online abuse that Anna suffered shows a blatant disregard for law, it shows a blatant disregard for morality, and I tell you what, it's absolutely ironic to me that following her death, the exact same platforms were then used for lynch mob mentality. So despite that anonymity order in place, the identities of Boye.
Feel off, tired, moody? You might be missing minerals because 99% of us are. Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder helps support energy, mood, and immunity from the inside out. Go to tracemineralz.com and feel the difference minerals make.
And Boy B were shared widely online. And that meant that the members of their families, they received death threats. In some cases, the wrong individuals were actually identified and threatened as well. So basically, the response to a blatant disregard for law and morality was itself a blatant disregard for law and morality. You know, this case demonstrates social media at its absolute worst. This is one of the rare cases where a child was brutalised and murdered by children. Just like the horrifying, heartbreaking 1993 James Bulger case. This is where the defendants were also controversially, in lots of people's opinions, given anonymity and new identities. And the reason that these cases are so disconcerting, so distressing, is they're at odds with our assumptions of childhood. They feel so distinct from what we imagine children should be doing and can be doing. In this case itself, it challenges us to recognise the impact that an easily accessible online world can have on developing minds. Now, I don't have any idea about Boye's psychology because very little has been disclosed. However, what I can tell you about is the fact that he had a loving, stable, and fairly privileged upbringing. You have to wonder what on earth caused him to do what he did. Never been in trouble with the police, no history of mental illness, had possibly, I guess, as I said earlier on, been desensitized to sexual violence on account of his browsing activities. You know, the access to that kind of material, it certainly, as far as I'm concerned, normalizes the abnormal. But you have to think there must be something else going on. Possibly we're looking at conduct disorder, developing antisocial personality disorder. And I think the reason I'm saying that, and I can't be certain, this is just my own position, my own point of view on it. The sadistic way that he killed Anna, he didn't just kill her. He wanted her to be terrified whilst he killed her. He attacked her in the dark room, in an abandoned house, wearing a zombie mask. That stuff of your worst nightmares. Now, Boye, he's recently been moved to an adult prison last year because he turned 18. And Boy B, who also turned 18 last year, he's began the process of appealing his murder conviction, but actually later down the line withdrew the application. Turns out both of those boys are at the same prison. But apparently that good friendship that they had, yeah, it's not there anymore. They are not on good terms. They once were very close friends, but now they no longer talk. I would imagine that's because Boy B blames Boy A for his incarceration and feels that he was essentially a pawn in the crime, which, if that's the case, isn't a good thing because Boy B needs to take responsibility for the part that he played in that murder. Like I said, I understand there is a distinction between the two, but taking responsibility and accountability means that when you're freed, we don't have to worry about you the same as we would if you refused to do that. because it means that you understand right from wrong and you will recalibrate your behavior accordingly. Anna's murder is a crime that shocked all the people in Ireland and anyone else who's heard about it. And they say many people feel so ashamed by what happened to Anna. You think about the fact that she was given this opportunity as a two-year-old to have a new, loved, happy life. And all Anna ever wanted was just to be happy, to be accepted, to make friends. Instead, she gets brutalized, bullied, and murdered. It's unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable. She was taken from her orphanage, a place that could have meant that she did have a relatively challenged life. But instead, she was removed by loving adoptive parents and placed in an area that she could thrive, that she could grow, where she could develop, where she could succeed. And it got stolen from her. Stolen. Following the sentencing, Anna's parents, Geraldine and Patrick, they paid tribute to her, saying this: Anna was a dream come true for us, and she always will be. So beautiful. So compassionate, so loving, and so true. She may no longer be alive. She may no longer be there physically, but her death doesn't steal her meaning. And for her parents, Patrick and Geraldine, saying that Anna was a dream come true for us and she will always be is a really powerful statement of that fact. And for Geraldine, the loss doesn't end there, because Patrick, Anna's father, Geraldine's husband, he sadly passed away in June 2022, just 4 years after Anna's murder. And Geraldine said he simply could not bear the pain of losing her. It is absolutely possible to die of a broken heart. And without a doubt, the stress and strain and agony of losing their much loved child, it really doesn't surprise me that in the end his body gave up. The only comfort I guess any of us can take, at least if they have a similar belief system to me, is that Patrick and Anna are together and that one day Geraldine will be reunited with them. It's a hard case today, isn't it? Kids that kill. It's always one that affects you slightly different on a psychological level. I do think that justice was served. I do think both of those boys should be in prison. And I can only hope that in the end, rehabilitation occurs and society has returned in the future at some point, whenever that is, to men who know what they did was wrong, who take accountability and responsibility for what they did, and who try to make good for the rest of their life, making a positive impact on society around them. Certainly, that isn't assured, as we know. Venables came out of prison years after murdering James Bulger and has offended again and again and again. But Robert Thompson, he apparently is living a pro-social life. Only time will tell. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.